Hi, family. I'm Samantha. I'm an alcoholic. Happy Mother's Day. And happy Mother's Day to the mothers. Let's see. I want to thank Susan for having me and asking me, and thank the welcoming committee yesterday with Julie and Brent and was it Peggy? It's Cindy, other Cindy. And I want to thank all those who I met last night. Welcome the newcomers. Welcome home, Ralph and Laura. Glad you guys are here. So I want to read a little something from the big book, and then we'll get into this whole thing. Because I'll tell you what, I am willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And I was telling Mark, my better half, that he said, "Man, you're gonna go to Bakersfield?" And I said, "Yeah, somewhere around Bakersfield up there." And I said, "You know, I would have done it for a drink, you know." And as I'm driving out here, I'm like, "No, this is about 78 miles beyond willing to go to any lengths. This is about no, I would not on the no." But if they said the only place you can get a drink is Springville, I would have said, "What time do you want me there?" So here's the deal. I'm going to read a little something here from A Vision for You. And, man, I'm really grateful to be here. But you guys got me a room. I don't know if you all know that. You got us a room, really nice room, with a pool. It was nice. We didn't get in the pool, though. There were a lot of kids in that pool last night. I was kind of scared. Okay, here we go. And I haven't smoked since October 12th. That doesn't mean I quit. And I don't like to quit. I don't like quitters. And I love to smoke. But I haven't smoked since October 12th. So I have a little Nicorette gum. I got a new habit. It's like $200 a month with the Nicorette gum. I don't even know what's going on there. It's ridiculous. I'm not an addict, really. Let's see. And I always like know right where this page is, but I'm nervous. And I'm going to try really hard not to use any, you know, not to drop any F-bombs or any, you know, negative language. Because I'm telling you, you can dress me up, but still, that ain't good. Okay, so, I know it's in A Vision for You. It's ridiculous. I'm just trying to kill time. Here we go. This is talking about, it's talking about those of us who are sort of like shipwrecked, you know, together. Here's the deal. Now and then, the less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, he's so poetic here, Bill, he's such a drama queen, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places. You got any sordid places here in Springville? Hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, "I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. I'm fine." I added that, "I'm fine. I'm fine, I feel good, I'm fine." As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. Jumping down. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, "Yes, I am willing. But am I to be consigned to a life where I should be stupid, boring, and glum?" Not unless you already were stupid, boring, and glum before you got sober. So, like some righteous people I see. I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It's the fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. I forgot to get tissue. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. How is that to come about, you ask? Where am I to find these people? You're going to meet these new friends in your own community. Near you, alcoholics are dying helplessly, like people in a sinking ship. If you live in a large place, thank you, there are hundreds. High and low, rich and poor, these are future fellows of Alcoholics Anonymous. Among them, you will make lifelong friends. You will be bound to them with new and wonderful ties, for you will escape disaster together, and you will commence shoulder to shoulder your common journey. Then you will know what it means to give of yourself, that others may survive and rediscover life, you will learn the full meaning of love your neighbor as thyself. So, let's pray. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Bob, how's that foot? Is that working for you, that foot? Yeah, good. Bob, geez. Love your stories. Love you guys have been so kind to us, and we've had such a good time just in this 24 hours. I'm really grateful that we're here, and it's been really nice. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. First of all, I have a sponsor. Her name's Catherine, and she's been sober 22 years, and she has a sponsor, and her name's Dawn, and Dawn has a sponsor. And I have quite a few sponsees, and they have some sponsees. And my sobriety date this time is September 5th, 1995. But there's been quite a few sobriety dates before that. My home group is the Sunday morning off center, 11 a.m. You're all welcome there. Hope to see you there next week. Let's see. I was told to wear a dress. I wear a dress to speak or to get a cake for sobriety. If I'm told in advance, I should wear a dress to give a cake as well. That's the school of thought that I was raised in. And nothing is too great to give to the program that saved my life. And it's really not saving my life that's sort of the miracle. It's really giving me a life worth saving. Because before I got here, I really was just sort of taking up space on the planet and was completely selfish, scandalous, and defeated. And so the deal is, here's the deal. And I just say this because I don't know, it doesn't really matter. This is not what makes me an alcoholic, but I'll just put it out there. Because I'll put it out there and then someone will come up to me after me and go, hey, that's me too. And then we bond and it's great. So I'm adopted. I'm the youngest of four. I was the only one adopted. My mom wanted to have three and adopt three. But the big story at the cocktail parties was after Samantha, we said we'd stop, you know. And so, I don't know if I took that to heart. So I don't think being adopted is what made me an alcoholic, but I'm certainly sure that that's part of what made me feel different. And I certainly played that card to the nth. In my seventh or eighth year of sobriety, I came to feel that I had some unresolved issues with that adoption. I thought that I had worked through it and had, you know, come to understand that I don't know all the information that my birth mom went through and what have you. But it's interesting that it's Mother's Day. Because I go through a little something, and I just wish her well. I hope she's well. I tried to find her a few years back, and the records were closed, and it was told to me that she didn't want any contact. And so we're very sensitive. Like, how could you not want to meet me, you know? How could you not want to know me? And so there's stuff, you know? There's just stuff there. And so being here on Mother's Day is kind of interesting. And I've been thinking a little bit about it. It's crossed my mind, and I just kind of put it out because I don't want that to be like the story, you know? But there's some stuff going on with that today. So I'll just put that out to you. And I was raised Lutheran. Don't know if that has anything, but I sure as hell don't have to worry about being Catholic. So thank God for that. No offense. But not really. And I'll tell you what's interesting about being raised Protestant, or specifically Lutheran, I'll tell you this really quick, is that the whole concept of it really is based on grace. See, where Catholicism in a lot of ways was, and a lot of other religions, if you will, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, if you want, about, you know, that you must do good works, that you must do good to be worthy of God's salvation, to do good, do good, do good. And really, you know, Lutheranism says basically you really can't do anything. You really can't do enough to be good enough for God. God just loves you anyway. That whole grace thing. No, you're not worthy. I just love you anyway. And grace is undeserved merit. It's undeserved. It's an undeserved gift. And so you never want me to be your sponsor, because the girls that come up to me and go, you know, I deserve to be happy, and I deserve a good life. And I'm like, you know, you deserve to be locked up for the rest of your life, frankly. If you got what you deserved, okay? So I'm like, good thing I get what I get and not what I deserve. I'm way more into mercy than I am into justice. And someone, a lot of people were talking about mercy last night. A merciful, loving God, and so on and so forth. You know, and I had a hard time with the God thing. I mean, that, you know, because here's the deal. I always knew there was a God, and I just hated him. That's the relationship we had. And what was it about? It was about because I'm not good enough. Again, missing the whole point of grace. And so that's kind of how I lived my life from very early on. I had my first drink, although it was masquerading in the form of skunk bud, but that's not important. we'll talk about that later. But there will be some outside issues that I mention, because I'm not a purist. Sorry. For you purists, I'll try to explain the whole process of, you know, THC and methamphetamine, what have you. The bottom line is I'm an alcoholic. That's it. And I'm an alcoholic because I drink primarily for the effect. And it's not how much I drink or what I drink. It's what happens to me when I drink. You see, my loving partner over there, who's, I don't use the word normie anymore. I don't think that's, what? He's non-alcoholic. Big difference. Normie doesn't exist. Okay, I was telling Eric about his wife. She's not normal. He's like, no, she's not really normal. She's just not an alcoholic. She's the kind of person that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, drink half a glass of wine and, you know, maybe half a glass of wine. She'll pour half a glass of wine, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe drink it, maybe say something really weird like, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. And that's set to the side. I don't, you know. And just like what Cindy was sharing, you know, the non-alcoholic women that would take her back to her home and see, you know, the messes, and couldn't understand how after 8 days or 5 days in the hospital you'd go and open the, you know, refrigerator and get two cans of beer and drink them. I can't understand why they wouldn't do that. You get out of the hospital, I need a drink. You know what I'm saying? See, if I just word the swear words, if I just mouth them, then they're not on the tape and my sponsor can't get upset with me. So, and you can't prove it. Oh, no. It was fire truck. Fire truck, that's what I said. Anyway, yeah, I don't understand those people. Those people make me a little nervous, and I'm uncomfortable. I mean, I won't say anything to you if you're, I mean, if you're at the other table and you're a complete stranger, I probably won't say anything to you. Like, aren't you going to finish that? But certainly if you're sitting at my table, I'll insist that not only you finish it, but you order another while you're finishing it. It just makes me so uncomfortable that you're not thinking about the next drink. I don't understand. That's how I am. I really wanted to come up here with my coffee and my water, but I thought, you know, that's just, you know, that's pushing it. So that's the point, though. He, you know, if he takes a drink, or perhaps if any normal or non-alcoholic people that you, in your life will take a drink, or even tie one on, maybe get a little tight, whatever, it's very likely, 99.9% of the time, you can bet on it, they will wake up in their own bed, they'll go to work the next day, they have a job while they drink. That blows my mind. They'll go to work the next day, and they'll pretty much know what happened the night before. Not so with me. Now, when I take a drink, may end up in my own bed, may end up in Atlanta, Georgia. You don't know. You just don't know. And that's what happened to me the last time I drank. So it's primarily drinking for the effect. It's that when I drink, I am like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, when I start to drink, I am never just sort of buzzed, but I'm more or less insanely drunk, you know. And so that, for me, is what makes me an alcoholic. And that I do indeed have an obsession of the mind coupled with an allergy of the body. And, you know, when it talks about it in step one in the 12 and 12, I mean, I love this part because, you know, I'll ask people, where are you at? Where are you at in the steps? I'm on step one. I'm working on step one. I'm working through step one. I'm on step one. I'm just kind of thinking about step one. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, get off step one. There is no solution in step one. Here's step one. You're doomed. You're doomed. You're doomed. You're doomed. That's step one. That's it. If you're like us, you're doomed. Goody. Now, if there weren't a step two, I'd say 22 to the head, let's go. We're out. Forget it. It's over. But there is a step two, thank God. But step one really breaks down in repetitive detail the fact that you have to have an ass kicking. that you have to be utterly defeated, completely defeated, total defeat, utter defeat, complete defeat. I mean, over and over. It's like, you got it? Complete defeat. Why in the world would you want to do the rest of the steps unless you had to? Nobody wants to do the rest of this. Nobody wants to be an AA, you know? Like, you know, Norm Alpe, you know, old-time speaker would say, you know, I didn't go down to my high school, you know, counseling office and say, yeah, you know, I'd like to take a couple classes to be an alcoholic, you know, can you hook me up with that? It's like, this isn't a goal. You know, I'd like to ruin a few people's lives, go to jail a couple times, and, you know, get put in five-point restraints. Can you work me out with that? Can we work that? So this is something that happens over a period of time. I don't know when it happened. I don't know when I crossed the line. I don't even care anymore. Because I'm just glad that I know that I am, as Cindy was talking about, conceding to my innermost self. Okay? And since my first AA meeting was like in March of 1983, and I got 10 and a half years sober, as I was sharing last night, you can do the math. I had a little trouble with step one. Because I got sober so young that there were so many yets. And there were so many yeah, buts, you know. I'm not like him. I'm not like them. An alcoholic is the old man in the trench coat with the, you know, bottle in the brown paper bag. You know, a drug addict is someone with a needle who's dying in the gutter. And that wasn't me, you know. I drink too much, a little bit, you know, 17, 18 years old. What do you expect? I throw up, you know, get into some trouble. It's no big deal. So, but it was a big deal. It was a big deal early on. Now, my first drink, I think, was probably, like I said, I'll tell you about this experience. I'm 9 years old. I know. It's late. I really could have had a drink at about four, but I waited till I was nine. And I'm over at my friend Lisa's house, Lisa Vogue, and she has older brothers that sell marijuana. And like I said, I don't want to apologize, but for those people who in the room that are alcoholics and a, you know, the alcoholic and a addict, the alcoholic and a drug addict, or the dope fiends, or the tweakers, or the speed freaks, whatever, you're all welcome here. But, you know, for me, it was hard to get alcohol at nine. It was actually easier to get pot at nine, believe it or not. So I'm not a purist, and I'm not going to apologize for any of that. I'm going to eat the meal, see. And the way the meal is served is in the 12 steps. And I'll eat the meal any way you serve it. I'll eat it in AA, OA, DA, CA, BA, GA, whatever you serve, I'll eat the meal because I'm starving. And people hate it when I get on the meal thing. Oh, geez, here she goes on the meal thing. But the deal about the meal deal, oh, just stop on, I've used that. Anyways, the deal about the meal is this. When I was little, and I was, you know, and I go to my mom and I say, what's for dinner? I'm starving. And she'd be like, fish. And I go, ooh, I hate fish. And she goes, well, then you're not really starving, are you? Now, see, I didn't really mean I was starving. I meant like I'd really rather have Twinkies or some kind of Hostess product for dinner. But the deal was at the Matern household, we're serving fish. And if you're hungry, you'll eat the way I'm serving it. And it's the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're going to serve it in Santa Barbara, and we're going to serve it in Springville, and we're going to serve it in San Diego, and anywhere else you go, I'm going to eat it the way you serve it. I'm not going to come up to you and go, hey, you know what, can I get that broiled with that on the side and put the... It's like, no, this is the way we serve it. Steps 1 through 12. And like I said, who's going to eat the meal unless you're starving? Because who cares to admit complete defeat, right? Who cares to, like, you know, find this power greater than themselves and start turning their will and their life, whatever the hell that is, over to the care of that higher power that you don't really trust that's never done you any favors, right? And who cares? I mean, really, who wants to write down a moral inventory of all your grosser handicaps and then share it with some stranger that you know is going to talk all about it the next AA meeting, they're going to talk all about you, and you know it's going to go all over the town. And then who cares anything, really, about releasing the grip on these character defects so that God can get in and remove them. Character defects that, frankly, in my opinion, are my survival tools. You mean you want to take my anger? Really? I don't think so. No, 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 no. My armor. My pride. Mm-mm. And then, of course, the humility factor. We don't even know what that is because we think humility is just like, you know, I'm terrible, I'm the worst, which isn't. That's just pride in reverse. You know? Humility isn't, I'm the worst. Humility is, I'm pretty good at that. I'm not so good at that. Okay? And then, you know, going and making amends, giving the people back their money? I don't think so. Really. That stuff's long gone. Prayer and meditation? No, I don't know anything about that. And, of course, this is the classic. I mean, who really cares about sacrificing time and energy carrying the message to some other ungrateful bitch who's not going to stay sober anyway? Can I say bitch? No. The average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care too much for these prospects unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. Now, it's interesting. It took me years into the program before I noticed it said alive, not sober. You don't have to do these things in order to stay sober. You have to do these things in order to stay alive. Now, if you're a quick thinker like me, you go, well, what kind of death are we talking about? Right? Because if it's a quick death, I might be likely to choose death. You know, choose spiritual life, you know, spiritual life, die an alcoholic death. Don't rush me. Wait, let me weigh this out. Spiritual life, alcoholic death. Fast death, slow death. Now, when I was 4 years sober, my sponsor took me through the 12 and 12. It's like I'd never been taken through the steps before. And I love the big book, and I love the 12 and 12, and I love all our literature. But I was able to see some things in a completely different way because we did a bunch of visualizations. And in the first step, it talks about the rapacious creditor. Now, I know what a creditor is. Hello. But I don't know what rapacious is. So you got to bust out the dictionary for this stuff. And I don't just give the big book to my newcomer and go, here, read the first 164 pages and call me. She ain't going to read this. You can't get through this stuff. This stuff was written by some pretty highly educated white men in suits. Okay? That's the way it was. And, you know, most of us don't even speak English. We speak American. So we don't know what the hell they're talking about in here. Rapacious creditor. So you got to look it up. And rapacious means this excessively greedy, voracious, constantly wanting, wanting, wanting. That's a rapacious creditor. My girlfriend, Naomi, used to say it's like this gnarly hand, you know, out of like Halloween or something. It just comes up from your gut and comes out of your mouth. It's like, gimme, gimme, gimme. That's the rapacious creditor. Right? And I have this visual of the rapacious creditor. And my visual is, you know, I close my eyes and I picture the last few weeks of my drinking or using. And I picture myself in the back of somebody's garage in this back room where there's ants all over the place. And it's very lonely. And I'm, you know, 20 pounds less than I am now with bruises all over my skin and, you know, in sort of these granny underwear and a t-shirt that haven't been washed for a long time, and I haven't eaten for a long time, and I am in sort of this fetal position in the back, huddled back of this room, and I hear these heavy footsteps walking up to the back of this screen door that's like on its last hinges, and I know who it is, you know, and my visual is this huge man, this huge person who is as tall as he is wide in this sort of overcoat with this 1940s fedora hat sort of pulled over his features, you know, huge hands. And the hands just, you know, just pound on the door, just like, and I, you know, I go, you know, I don't want to, you know, just go away, go away, go away. And of course, he's not going away. And he does it again, you know, and I just say, what? You know, like, what do you want? And he goes, you know what I want. You know. And I go, I don't have anything. I gave you everything. You already took it all. I don't have my job. I don't have a car. My family's gone. No one will talk to me. You know, I haven't eaten. I haven't slept. I have nothing. You know, there's nothing I have to give you. Just go. And you hear this sort of low, guttural laugh, you know, in the back of his throat. And he goes, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about everything that's precious in your life. I want your dignity. I want your self-respect. I want your integrity. For a woman, I want everything that is precious, anything that is light, anything that is remotely beautiful in you. That's what I want. You know, and take it. Just take it. Just take it and go. And so now I have met my alcohol. I mean, now I have met my alcoholism. And it's like, it's nothing personal, really. It's just, that's its job. It's kind of like, why would I get in the ring with Muhammad Ali in his heyday? You know, if I just meet him on the street or have a cup of coffee with him, I bet you he's a sweet guy. But if I get in the ring with Muhammad Ali, here's the deal. He's going to kick my ass. It's his job. That's what he does. Now, maybe you can relate to this, especially us relapsers. Maybe we can relate to this. It's like, yeah, but... Rookie. Go on. Hurry up. We'll wait because you're a newcomer, so come on. Can't even believe you have a cell phone. You're way too well. You don't have a cell phone, Laura, do you? That's right. See? Sufficient ass kicking. What's up, Marcy? I know. All right. Anyways, ass kicking. So, the crazy thing is that I'll say, how about just one round? One round. Well, yeah, sure, go ahead. Get in one round with Muhammad Ali. It's going to be different this time because I have a new pair of boxing shorts. Have you seen these new boxing shorts? This is going to do it. And I've been working on my moves. It's like, you know, whatever you need to do, Sammy, but the bottom line is that he's going to kick your ass. It's his job. That's alcohol's job. It's just what happens, nothing personal. So as soon as I start sort of seeing the rapacious predator in that way, I don't want to mess around. I know what I'm dealing with, okay? The rapacious predator bleeds me of all self-sufficiency and all will to resist its demands. And in the second part of step one, it talks about the tyrant. So here's another visual. And you really got to meet the tyrant, alcohol. If you don't know what a tyrant is, look it up. A cruel, oppressive ruler. If you don't know what oppressive is, I mean, I'm in the dictionary constantly, you know, just like, what, the, you know, is it the or the? You know, look it up. Because I don't know what I'm reading. And when you look it up, you know, you got the idea. And the tyrant, alcohol, is like, you know, he's coming in with a double-edged sword, which is unfair right off the bat, and I'm going in with a pencil. Here we go. At best, you know, but it's very sharp, but it's a number two. You know, that's step two. That's just insane. That's insane. That's insane. And we do it time after time after time after time. And you stay sober long enough, you stay sober long enough, and you love enough alcoholics, you start going to a lot of funerals, and you end up in Al-Anon. But that's another story. All right. So, the whole step one is there's no solution there. Let's get on to step two, okay? And we'll get to step two. So basically, the bottom line is, you know, I started drinking pretty young. I get sober pretty young. They put me into a drug rehab for teenagers. And the message is brought to me through hospitals and institutions. And for the first time in my life, I understand that perhaps I'm not bad, perhaps I'm sick, you know? And although I didn't stay sober from that time on, I struggled in and out. And my life was never the same. That's the bitch of this thing, is that once you get this, once you've been in these meetings, even for a little bit, once you laugh, oh my gosh, we got you. You know, we got you. And your drinking, it is over for me. And I may continue for the rest of my life to try to get that back. And every single time I'm going, damn those AAs. You know what I mean? And it talks about that in the 12 and 12. I love this part. It talks about in the 12 and 12, you know, step one. Because you've got to get step one down, man. And step one, you don't work step one. Step one works you. That's my opinion. You know? There's only one thing that's going to convince me that I'm an alcoholic. You know what it is? That's right. Alcohol. And so as much as I want to say to the newcomer, keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle. Don't leave after the miracle. Keep coming back. Welcome back. We want you to stay. The book is very clear about what I am to say. And what I am to say is perhaps you're not an alcoholic after all. Maybe you should try some controlled drinking, bearing in mind what we've told you about alcoholism. And the book says this attitude brought immediate and practical results. Because it was once discovered that when one alcoholic planted in the mind of another alcoholic the true nature of his malady, look that one up, his sickness, his disease, that alcoholic could never be the same again. It's over. Bummer. And that's what I mean. Step one is full of that. Oh, bummer. You know? Step one is here. Here's the deal. We found that you're the victim And just enjoy that for a second, because you ain't going to get victim for very, very much of this program, that's for damn sure. You're the victim of a mental obsession so subtly powerful that no amount of human willpower can break it. Now, we hear those words, we read those words, but every once in a while we go, well, my kids can help me. Or my wife can help me. My old man can help me. That job can help me. I'm making more money than I've ever made in my life. No amount of human willpower. And what do I got to do? I got to watch as each person goes through all the lists of all the different human things on this planet that might save him. I had to do the same thing. You know, and the desire is that, you know, I want to make you desperate. My third year sober, I'm like sponsoring people where it's just like, you're desperate. You know, it's like, no, you're not. You're not desperate. And I guess if I had one more collect phone call where someone would accept my collect phone call, you know, maybe. And not everybody has to get low as some other people, but some of us do, you know. I was always really resentful at the people that still got to this program with like a car, you know. And in Santa Barbara, it's like a Mercedes, you know. And I'm like, they're not done. They still have a car. They're not done. They still have a watch, you know. The old timers, I spilt more than you drank, you know, that kind of shit. And the reality is finally my sponsor comes to the rescue. And she says, you know, Samantha, it was really easy for you to get sober. You had a garbage bag of stuff. Your drug dealer drove you out from Atlanta, Georgia. Your drug dealer drove you out of state. That's how bad they wanted you out of that state. Drove you to recovery in California, 3,000 miles. And I'm like, well, it was a large garbage bag, God, you know. Really big. It's huge. Twist tie and everything. And so, you know, she's right. It's harder to get here and admit complete defeat when you have stuff. So I honor those people that get here without having to lose their families and their jobs, and they still have two cars in the garage and so on and so forth. That's a tough thing. And instead of criticizing them, I need to honor that, you know? Because, you know, I wouldn't wish alcoholism on anybody. Even though, you know, drugs and alcohol were the very thing that brought me to my knees so sufficiently that I had to find a power greater than myself and give me a life beyond my wildest dreams. But, you know, and so today my alcoholism is a different way. It's a different way I look at it. What a gift. And there's a lot of gifts. In fact, dare I say, oh, people hate this because I hated it, that everything's a gift. They don't always come really wrapped up in these beautiful packages with red bows. But I'm starting to learn that everything is a gift. We'll get to more of that later. So I get sober. I stay sober for a while. You know, I'm in and out. I stay sober for 6 or 7 months and, you know, go out again and what have you. And I move down to L.A. I'm living by the airport. I'm doing, you know, whatever 19, 20-year-old girls do for alcohol and cocaine and doing those kind of things. And, you know, and I hit a bottom. And one day I simply called that therapist that had been so wise, because I had seen a bunch of therapists. I had therapists that had the lava lamps, and I had therapists that prayed over me in tongues, which I think probably would have been more helpful had I gone to those sessions not stoned. But then again, perhaps I got more out of them stoned. I don't know. The fact is, there was something very wrong with Samantha, I felt, from a very early age. When you got people praying tongues over you, you know, I'm like, what the? Okay. So this particular therapist, he was the kind of therapist that was at that drug rehab, and he said to me, as soon as I go in there, he goes, you know, your parents seem pretty square. And I'm like, oh, yes, this is an ally. They're totally square. You know, you could come in here, check yourself in here, vacation from the parents, don't have to go to school. I'm like, where do I sign, you know? Now, I didn't know back in the 80s, you know, the big drug rehabs for kids and whatever, that clink, clink, it's a totally locked facility. You know what I mean? We're not going anywhere. It's a psych ward, for God's sakes. You know, I go, well, let me just go home and get some stuff. No, we think someone will bring you your stuff. You know? Well, okay. Can you say intervention? That's what it was. And so anyways, I dabble here and there, and I call this therapist again. I say, I think I'm done. You know, I need some help, whatever. And I go through a woman's recovery home in Pasadena, and I stayed sober for 6.5 years. And I was in the program, no doubt about it. Had a great life, found a career in radio that was wonderful. Had a great time. And got married and had a house and cars and jacuzzis and all kinds of good stuff. And then the five most infamous words I hear are, I quit going to meetings. Okay? Now, I hear other things now and then. Like I was sharing last night at the meeting. Every now and then I hear, you know, I don't know what happened. You know, I was going to meetings and hitting my knees and reading the big book and working with my sponsor. And I was sponsoring people and I was praying and speaking. And I think to myself, well, you're doomed. And I think to myself, well, then maybe AA doesn't work. Because if you can't find what went wrong, then what you're telling me is AA went wrong. And my experience is that these steps work perfectly. I mean, they work perfectly. If you don't want to get sober, don't do the steps, because you'll get sober. You'll get sober whether you want to or not. I mean, truly, because something happens. Something happens midway through, right at the beginning. It depends. But something happens where there's a change. Perhaps it's a psychic change. Perhaps it's a spiritual awakening. Perhaps it's some sort of an understanding that there is a power greater than you. Now, how many people have been incarcerated here? Come on, don't be scared. It's not on videotape. Right. Now, you know, so many of the people that I know, including myself, that have been incarcerated, struggle with this idea of a higher power, which is just silly to me, because every single correction officer in the state of California was a power greater than you. You know? Come on. The IRS is a power greater than me. I mean, there's a lot of powers greater than me. So why I struggle with that, I don't know. Maybe it's an arrogance thing. I have no idea. But I'll tell you what, where we're at right now is alcohol and drugs have always been a power greater than me. If not, I should have been able to stop by myself. And stopping is never the problem. I hear people all the time say, I stopped a million times, I stopped. It's staying stopped. Don't you get it? Stopping isn't the problem. Most of us in here probably stopped 10, 20 times. Staying stopped is the thing. This sustained stopping, for lack of a better word. And if I look at it as a disease, which the American Medical Association says it is, then why in the world can't I get the fact that cancer or diabetes or anything else require a certain amount of maintenance to live life normally? Or you get very, very sick. Pretty simple. There's a certain amount of things that I have to do. I've got to take the medicine. Now, why don't we take the medicine? Well, that's step two. That's getting back in the ring. Have you seen the new boxing shorts? I don't need it. I don't need the medicine anymore. I don't want to take the medicine. I don't like the side effects. I'm tired. I don't like it. I don't want to drive there. I don't want to go there. Okay. My standard of how I behave in AA is very simple. All I got to do is say, would I have done that for a drink? Boom. End of answer. Would you pick that guy up for a drink? Would you have gotten that girl for a drink? Would you? Yep. And if the only place I could have gotten a drink was Springfield, I would have done that too. Springfield, I keep going that. What is that, the Simpsons? Is that Springfield? It's cute. Anyway, it's very simple in that way. Not saying I'll do it the rest of my life. You know? I don't know. I mean, I know when people say, I don't know how it works. I don't know how I'm sober. I'm like, shit, there's a whole chapter in how it works. That's how it works. Next question, you know? I don't know how it works. I'm just so grateful. It's like, come on, buddy. You know? So anyway, don't know where I was. But, you know, I stayed sober for 6.5 years. I quit going to meetings, and here's the deal. I'm at a bar with my husband and a girlfriend, neither of whom have ever seen me drink before. And you know how they are? When you say you're an alcoholic, yeah, okay, you know. They don't really get it. They don't really get it because they never seen you drink. And so we're at a bar, and we're shooting pool, whatever, and I'm always the designated driver, no big deal, whatever. And it's been about maybe 3, 4, 5 months since I've been to a meeting. And they're talking, and, you know, I'm looking at this half a glass of white Zinfandel. And I'm, you know, just beep. Now, there's silence at the table. Much like it's very quiet in the room right now. And a couple seconds go by, my girlfriend reaches over and pats me on the knee, and she says, well, good for you. So you know. Yeah, they don't know. Now, this is why I speak. This is not at all for you. This is all so that I will never, ever, ever forget this. That from the deepest part of my soul, there came a very quiet but very clear voice that said, here we go. Those words exactly. Here we go. And I knew that I did not know what that meant. I did not know where we were going, but I knew that we were going. And the next scene I remember in that night is me banging on the bar going, "I want something to help me drink longer." And the bartender like, "Ixnay on the S amphetamine bay," you know, like, "You're blowing it, you know." Yeah. And I'm 28 years old, and I've never been arrested. I've never stuck a needle in my arm, and within 2 months, I'm sticking needles in my arm, and I'm getting arrested. And for the next 2 months, I'm sorry, for the next 2 years, I was arrested 11 times and put in 3 psych wards and ended up in Atlanta, Georgia. Because I'm an alcoholic that slams methamphetamine, which means I'm a very busy drunk that never gets anything done. And is extremely scandalous in the process. Because I can't work. I can't work. Come on. You should have seen me, you know. The radio station, I got hired at a radio station in Arizona. The biggest radio station, the biggest rock radio station in the state. Huge. Okay? And I've been doing it a while. And I'm a good jock. I'm a good disc jockey. I'm a good radio personality. Now, I open the mic, and I can't see. I can't remember where I am. I can't remember what I'm doing. Brent knows. I cannot see. And the red line's blowing up. You know, the red line, you know. The red line, you know, and I can't function, you know, just, it's like, go try to do a little book job or something, but don't get on the major market radio and not be able to talk. Something's going to go, the phone lights are just blank. Anyways, lost that job, needless to say. And I'll never forget, because the program director who thought I was, I mean, I had this reputation, and there were like banners when I got there, Sammy from, you know, L.A., oh, God, that poor guy. And he took me in, you know, and fired me, and he said, you know, on a personal level, you know, is this about, you know, man, you got a drug or alcohol problem? Because I've been there, he says. No, it's this guy that I'm with. I saw him like 3 years later after I'd been sober a while. We saw each other at a convention from like across the room. And he just, I saw him, and you know how our eyes are kind of sparkly? And I don't know if mine were. He said mine were, but the light on his face, the smile that just came across his face, like, wow, you know? Wow. And truly a testament to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was bad, you know, for those 2 years. And I'm going to share a couple of truths, my truths with you. And here's a few of them. One of them is that everything I judge, I walk through. Everything I judge, I walk through. Think about it. Everything. The divorce, who's sleeping with the newcomer, who's doing this, who's doing that, who's pushing it. I walk through, maybe not exactly, but on some level where I remember, ooh, now I understand. And there's a very key thing here. When I was 6.5 years sober that last time, I worked as a counselor, and I worked with teenagers and young adults. And a client that I had was in a very, very abusive relationship. And I would say to her, just leave. Just leave. It's ridiculous. You just pack up your shit and you leave. Okay? And she couldn't. And she'd come in and she'd be beat up and we'd call the, you know, and it was just like, and now I said something to her and I'll never forget it. And it wasn't exactly these words, but it was certainly implied, clearly. Something to the effect of, you give my gender a bad name. And as I was being strangled by this man that I loved, and he had a very great talent. He wouldn't hit me because that's too, you know. But he was a strangler. And don't get me wrong, I deserved it. But, you know, I mean, and ladies, don't come up and talk to me after this meeting. We never deserve it, because I'll tell you right now, I have the ability to emasculate you with my words. And after a while, if you can no longer communicate with me in words, and you have been completely struck down to the most unmasculine form, sometimes you need to be stopped. Now, I'm not saying it was wrong, and that's all there is to it. We were wrong. The point here is that he knew how to strangle me, and as I was coming back from being unconscious, and I had wet my pants, so I'm sitting in my own urine, coming back from being strangled to unconsciousness,
I thought of Michelle. And I thought, well, that's why she can't leave. Because I couldn't leave either. And so the lesson of compassion has been taught to me by everything that I judge I walk through. And I'm very careful now. Very careful. You know? And the lessons that I have learned, sober and otherwise, really, are directly proportional to how much I paid for that lesson. In other words, the value of the lesson that I've learned is directly proportional to the amount I paid. So if the lesson is very valuable, like life-changing valuable, you're going to have some scar tissue around that one. You will have paid a dear price for that. And a woman came up to me the other night at a meeting and she said, you know, you're so lucky. And I said, luck has nothing to do with it. Luck has nothing to do with it. I have done the work. And I have the scar tissue to prove it. And it's really interesting, as I sat there and I finally, you know, ended up, you know, great. So the end of the last month of my drinking, if you will, was I had stabbed this man because I love him. And I stabbed him because he was leaving with a full jar of peanut butter. I want you to know that. Now, I hadn't eaten in years, but that's not the point. The point is that I may have wanted to eat eventually, and I needed that peanut butter. Brother. So, you know, poke in the head. And, of course, the head wound looks way worse than it is. It really wasn't that bad, but it looked really bad. And he's calling the cops, you know, and here I am, you know, in my work uniform in Atlanta, Georgia, and I worked at this place called Barnacles. Don't ask. But anyways, it, you know, and the outfit was these short shorts and this tight little t-shirt and the apron, you know, and I got blood all over this thing, right? And I'm hitchhiking down Jimmy Carter Boulevard, and some guy picks me up, and I, you know, give him the whole, I was abused, I'm abused, whatever. He's like, oh my God, you know, let me take you somewhere, you know, knowing that. And all I'm hearing is, woo, you know, sirens are coming to my place, because the guy's coming. Good times, good times. Yeah, anyway. Bottom line is, I called this woman that had been my sponsor one time, and I just said, I think I'm done. And she said, thank God, you know. And through this whole time, you know, you can't have that much sobriety. And 6.5 years may not be a lot of sobriety, but it was enough to really be in the light for quite a while. And it's very difficult to be in the light and be in the dark at the same time. It's very difficult. And once you've had the light, it's very hard to go into the dark completely. I was getting close, but there were certain things that always kept pulling me back, and a lot of it had to do with my animals, believe it or not, you know. They were some damaged animals, man. Every place that I lived had broken door jams because the doors had been broken in by cops or by guys or whatever, and one of my dogs had a big welt that the cop had hit her while I was out of it or whatever, you know, because she was angry and mean just like me. And, you know, so everyone was damaged, you know what I'm saying? And, this woman said, come home. Come to Santa Barbara. Go into Casa Serena. Get there. I don't care how you get there. Now, I had a car which was long stolen. I mean, essentially, I mean, I bought it originally, but I'd stopped making famous a year and a half ago. And, you know, but I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, so what could they do? And the guy that sold me pot, actually, good guy, he'd always say, why do you have to drink so much? You know, and I'd be like, why don't you? I don't understand. He said, just smoke pot. You know, if I just could just smoke pot, I just can't. I got to drink. And he actually rented a car, left my car there, never seen that car since, and drove me 3,000 miles out to Santa Barbara. Drove me out here. And, you know, I climbed up the steps to Casa Serena, and that's where it began for me again on September 5th, 1995. And, you know, I'll say this for those people who have been in recovery homes or who are currently now in a recovery home, just so you know, my opinion. My opinion is my experience, so you can't really argue with me. My experience is that recovery homes are not Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? They're a place to store your shit while you go get sober, but they're not Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's how I know that. Because at 60 days sober, they kicked me out because I was too angry. Go figure. That kind of thing. Well, she threw my stuff, all my laundry stuff, all over the garage. That's fighting words. No blood was spilled, but I did climb over the dining room table. during dinner, which can be scary, I guess, to some people if they're wimps. Wimps. You're inappropriate. You're inappropriate, Samantha. You can't stay. You need to leave. You're inappropriate. Now, I've heard that word forever. Like on report cards, she seems very bright, a bit talkative, and at times inappropriate. That's my, you know, that's my key, under my, you know, name. That's who I am. A little inappropriate. And I am so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has never said that I was too inappropriate to be here. Because where would I go? Who would have me? You know? And not that I haven't had to make amends or asked to leave a meeting, but, you know, keep coming back, you know, as they throw you out kind of thing. And you truly loved me. I mean, you know, I'm sorry if, you know, these were a cliche, you know. Yeah, you loved me till I could love myself. You said some of the most loving words to me, and here was one of the things that the old-timers said a lot to me. You're not that scary. You're not that scary. Sit down. Sit down. It's going to be okay. Sit down. Sit down, sweetie. It's going to be okay. Huge for me. Huge. That game didn't work on you. And I'm so grateful. And if there is, if you guys run into a newcomer that's scary, I just want you to know that it's really scary being that scary. And it feels like it's never going to be okay. And that I'll never be appropriate. And that I'll never be okay. I'll never be okay. Because I already know I'm fucking broken. Excuse me. I already know I'm broken. And so, you guys have taught me about the spirituality of imperfection. That it's the crack in the vase that is the most beautiful thing about that vase. You know? I only have a few more minutes, I'm sorry. So, you know, I got sober, and that's really the deal. You know, and I started doing it just like I had done it before, you know? And 17 days sober, you know, Judy gave me a chip, welcome home. Welcome home. Welcome home. You are my family. I don't really like all you. But I'd do anything for you. Do anything for you. So, so what life has been like, and I'll try to get through this as quickly as possible, you know, what life has been like the last few thousand days has been, you know, I started doing the deal like we do it, you know, and I did the steps like we do them, you know, and the steps are the tools, you know, and again, the steps are there and you're going to eat them the way we serve them if you're starving, you know. And you're going to do the fourth step, and you're going to do the fourth column, and you're going to do the fears list, you know, and you're going to do the sex inventory. And the sex inventory, really, you know, in my opinion, the sex inventory is the hardest part of the fourth step, because I'll tell you why, a number of reasons. First of all, it's not all about who you slept with. In fact, it's not at all about that. Because most of the people you slept with, you probably didn't hurt, unless they wanted it, and then, you know, that's, again, that's a whole different story. It's a whole different program. But it says, whom did you hurt? So did I hurt the married guy? Or did I hurt his wife? Right? Whom did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Well, not the married guy, but do you think the wife is at home going, where is he? Where is he? What is going on? Should I call hospitals? What should I do? Right? Where did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where did I play with my sex powers? Where did I lead you on? Where did I know that there was a good guy that genuinely liked me and I worked him over for the bag or for whatever else I needed? That's the stuff. That's the stuff that's hard to look at, you know? And here's the kicker. What should I have done instead? No part in the fourth step, resentment part, doesn't say, what should you have done instead? It says, where was I at fault? But this part says, what should you have done instead? And sometimes it's as simple as, I shouldn't have slept with him, you know? But what should I have done instead? Because the sex inventory is part of shaping a sane and ideal sex life. It's part of who we are. Our sex powers are God-given.
They're not to be abused or used lightly, nor are they to be something that we're ashamed about. But there's some serious power there, ladies. Be careful. I need to be careful. And it's hard sometimes because the old tools come back and you want to use that old tool because I think I need the survival tool. And here's the deal. I don't want to survive anymore. I'm done surviving. I want to live. I need some living tools. I already know how to survive. Survival's like caveman goosh, you know? Shit, man, I'm done. I'm done. I don't want to do it anymore. You know? When I was 7 months sober, my sponsor looked at me, and when I came into this program, this is all I wore. Uggs, sweats, flannels. The back of my head was shaved. I had gotten my two teeth knocked out in a fight a while ago. And my terrible acne problem, my hair was always in my face. And when I was 7 months sober, my sponsor looked at me and she said, I want you to start wearing a dress once a week. And I was like, now, it's interesting, it didn't say, screw you. Nothing. I was terrified at the thought that I would have to wear something that would draw attention to me. Right? And without a beat, she says, and brush your hair. And I swear to God, I looked at her and I said, on the same day? And she laughed, no, no, let's not get crazy. Right? I'll never forget, you know, one time when I was getting loaded, and I was, you know, like I said, that's how I looked. And I remember going to the dope man and sort of like trying to sort of work it, like, you know, could I get a little something, something, you know, a little something, something. And he just looked at me like, no. And just like tossed me something, you know, like, please, no. Oh, he can only see me now. What a difference a dentist makes, huh? Make sure, sorry now. Anyway, so, you know, I started doing what we do, and, you know, I started going back to school, and I started doing exactly what we do, is just stand in line and pay the money and jump through the hoops and go do that and just do the next right thing. Dip, started going to junior college. Soon I had enough units to go to the big kid school, and I went to UCSB, and, you know, and here I am, and, you know, all of a sudden, a couple years, and wow, you know, I got enough to graduate, you know, with a degree. And you know, I remember thinking, because I was in the drug rehab when my senior class graduated. So I didn't do the whole, you know, robe and cap and gown. And people are like, are you going to graduate? Are you going to, like, walk in the ceremony? I'm like, hell yes, I am. You know, it's like, I want the whole da, 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 da. You know, I want the whole thing, man. I want balloons and flowers. I want a party. And hell yes, you know. And after a while, and by the way, I went entirely through college, through the State of California Department of Rehabilitation. So if you want to go back to school, thanks to all the taxpayers, of which I am one now, but the fact is that if you're a drug addict and alcoholic, outside issue, you can go to school. So just check it out. Don't make this harder than you have to. There are people that have dedicated their lives to ending our suffering, so why don't you just go ahead and give them a chance to do their job? Okay? It's the same thing with medicine or anything else, any other outside issue. And I'll just say this because I'm a soapbox for 1 second. If anybody, you know, here's the deal with the medicine, as far as I'm concerned. I don't care, it's none of my business, but da-da-da, here's the deal. Because my own personal experience with someone who I judged and then never showed up to the morning meeting again because he hung himself. I'm not saying it was my fault or her fault or AA's fault, but I'm just saying, unless you graduated from medical school, shut the up. You know, and if there are people in here that are scared of what AA says, you know, you shouldn't be talking about it anyway from the podium. So that's all I'm going to say. Anyways, all right. You know, but it's between you and your creator, and that's that. So I started going to school, and, you know, I graduated, and all of a sudden I thought, well, you know, why don't I just go to law school? Seemed like a good place to hide out. So I went to law school, and my husband at the time, I had gotten married in my 5th year of sobriety, and we were together 7.5 years, and during that time, I asked him, you know, what kind of law should I practice? He's like, Avi, criminal. You know what I mean? And I remember being in 5-point restraints, completely naked, and five, like, you only have 4-point restraints. I'm like, no, 5-point restraints. That's right. See, sister. There you go. 5-point restraints. And with my bottom teeth knocked out, completely naked, with about 5 cops looking over me going, it looks like she might have been pretty once. And I remember thinking, I'm sorry, Sammy. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, baby. I'm sorry. And to get to the point where I can talk to myself like that is a whole different path if you're new. But it happens. It happens. It happens. I'm sorry, baby. I'm sorry. You know, it's going to be different this time. And then just doing that, you know, delivering on that. And so I took the bar a couple times, and I took it again this last time in February, and we actually find out on the 19th. And so it's been a really interesting experience for me. I've been asked to speak a lot lately, and I think it has a lot to do with just kind of keeping me busy and keeping me on my primary purpose and keeping me on the path, because the path isn't to be an attorney. I mean, it might be, but that's not my goal. That's not my primary purpose. I don't ever want to get too busy living the life AA gave me to give back to AA. Come on. Too busy? I used to live in a car with no windows, okay? That wasn't mine. So, we've come a ways. And, you know, I'm just going to close with this. There was a struggle I had going through a divorce. It was the most painful experience of my life. And I'm not going to really get too much into it. The bottom line is, and people have been through way worse. But I've never been this old, I've never been this sober, and I've never gone through a divorce. Never done that. The first marriage I had was annulled. I left after 6 months of starting getting loaded, and it was nothing. This was a biggie. We met when I was 10 months sober. We stayed together till I was, you know, till we were 7.5 years sober. And, you know, it was a very, very painful experience. And here's the lesson that I learned. And again, the lesson that I learned is directly proportional to the price I paid. So I paid a hell of a price for this one. And here's the deal. I don't ever want to spray paint my red flags green. Let me just say that again. I don't ever want to spray paint my red flags green. If you don't know what I mean, here's what I mean, Ralph. Here's what I mean, brother. We have a divine, we are divine. We co-create, I think, with my creator. And my divinity, my higher self, will say to me, ooh, be careful with, ooh, maybe not that one. Ooh, you might not want. And I'll bust out my green spray paint can. I'll just go, shh, that ain't red. Because it's the most money I've ever made in my life as I go to meet that guy, right? That new employer. Or, this may not be something I can live with. Shh, you can't do any better than Dan. He's a great guy. He's the best. He loves you. It's so wonderful. And besides, you know, if you don't marry him for that reason, that's so superficial. You're such a snob. What will people think? Shh. And I'll tell you what, I will never, I mean, I am very aware now. And if something that is not okay with me is not okay with me, it's not okay. I can't live with that. I have to have someone growing along spiritual lines, or I'm dead, and I won't respect you. And it'll be over. And I'll destroy lives and families. And at 2 years into the dating, I knew something's not right. But I couldn't say it because I was ashamed and I was embarrassed. And I listened to a lot of people that said, you can't do any better than that. He's the great. Okay, you're right. Shh. And families and lives and my sobriety hung in the balance, and it was crazy. And I found that I had to find a God that was bigger than that pain. And the God that had worked for me from 1 to 7 was fine. But you know what? At 7 years sober, I needed a bigger God. I needed a bigger God. And it reminds me of the story about Jim. Jim, who owned the auto dealership in the Big Book, right? And he loses the auto dealership to drinking. And he goes into the insane asylum, and he comes back out, and they give him a job at the business he used to own. There's a little humiliating stuff, right? And one day he goes into work, and he has words with his boss, and he's all pissed off. You can just see Jim, oh, whatever, you know? And he drives off into the country to go tend to some people, maybe sell him a car, and he stops at the roadside diner, and he thought, which is dangerous right there, that perhaps if I put a little whiskey in my milk on a full stomach, it wouldn't do me any harm. So he does it. He tries it. You know, puts a little whiskey in the milk, has a sandwich. The experiment went so well, he did it again and again. And then the book says, and then one more trip to the asylum for Jim. Now, the AAs are coming to his room, right, and they're talking to him. You know, that's the last thing you want to see is a bunch of clean-cut AAs right in the hospital bed. You're like, oh, shit. And so they come in, they're like, hey, Jim, what's up? Whiskey in the milk, good move. You know? What happened? And here's what they found out. That Jim had failed to enlarge his spiritual life. I gotta grow. My God is big enough now to get me through that. And here's how I know. Remember I'm talking about the scar tissue? Here's the most loving thing, and then I'm going to sit down. Thanks for letting me talk. Scar tissue is stronger than the tissue you were born with. That's a fact. Scar tissue is stronger than the tissue you were born with. Who the hell thought that up? That is brilliant. That is a compassionate God, I'm telling you what, to actually make the tissue that grows over those cuts and those wounds stronger than the stuff I was born with. Wow. That's pretty cool. You know, that's amazing to me. And you guys are part of that for me. To have carried me through stuff I could never, ever do myself. To say, just get in the car. To say, just shut up and speak. Just do it. It'll be okay. You know, if it weren't for people like you and rooms like this and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed it all. Thanks.